Welcome to the Playgroup Q&A podcast from Nick Hearn Books. Each week during the coronavirus shutdown, Nick Hearn Books is making one play available completely for free and asking everyone who reads it to send in a question for the writer. I'm your host, Sian Mayhall-Purvis. I work at Nick Hearn Books. And for this week's episode, I spoke to Chris Bush about her epic and provocative play, Faustus, That Damned Woman. This reimagining of the classic cautionary tale was co-produced by Headlong and Lyric Hammersmith Theatre in association with the Birmingham Repertory Theatre and directed by Caroline Byrne. It was first performed at the Lyric Hammersmith Theatre in January 2020 before embarking on a UK tour, which was sadly cut short by the theatre shutdown. Spoiler alert, we will be discussing the play in full, including its ending. Chris spoke to me from her home in southeast London, and I started our conversation by asking her to describe Faustus, That Damned Woman in her own words.
Faustus, That Damned Woman is a retelling or a reimagining of the Faust legend, which has existed for hundreds of years, asking what would it mean to have a female Faustus, and sort of exploded through that, I guess. It's about how historically and currently women have been treated, are still treated differently today. The original Faustus tends to be a figure who sells their soul because they're bored or because they want more sort of materialist gain, whereas my Faustus sort of starts from the position of being a woman of lowly birth in the 17th century, going, actually, if I want to get anywhere in this life, the devil is sort of my best and only option.
And how did the play come about?
I've always been drawn to the Faustus myth. I've been familiar with it for a while. I was in a production of Goethe's Faust when I was a teenager in Sheffield, which is sort of even madder than the Marlowe. And if you do the full thing, it's about 10 hours long.
Wow.
There's a special theatre called the Goetheanum, which is basically constructed only to perform this totally unfeasible play. There's something brilliant in that story of a person who sells their soul to the devil, and we see it sort of cropping up in various different forms, in various different stories sort of throughout history in lots of different cultures. And it's the classic sort of be careful what you wish for, and it does this brilliant thing of putting an audience immediately into that mind of, okay, well, what would I do? What would I want? What would I ask for? What would I be prepared to give up? Would I be virtuous, or would I sort of give in? Could I be tempted? But I think the problem is, or one of my problems is, with Marlowe, it has these sort of extraordinary sequences in it. It has amazing bits of poetry, but as a narrative, it's sort of a bit all over the place. And one of the reasons for this, I think, is that Faustus in the Marlowe certainly has everything to begin with, more or less. He's reached the end of his, of what he can achieve through mortal means. And so he reaches out to the devil because he wants to go even further, which is not uninteresting, but I think there's a potential to sort of look beyond someone who is not just sort of being greedy, as it were, but coming from a position of a lower starting point and of sort of really being pushed towards the devil as having no other option. And so I'd been interested for a while, and then it all happened quite quickly and quite organically in that I had a meeting with Headlong 2 or 3 years ago, I guess not all that long ago, where I came in for a general sit down, pitched 3 different ideas, one of which was this take on Faustus, and that was the one that they said, yep, we like the sound of that, go ahead and do that. And then that's sort of the road from there to production was relatively smooth, actually.
How long did it take you to write the play?
It was quite a quick writing process, really. I think the first draft got written in probably about 6 months, something like that. It was only around a year between it all being sort of confirmed and commissioned to going into rehearsal, which is pretty unusual. A slot emerged at the Lyric Hammersmith in the way that sometimes things do, and I was able to sort of say, yep, I can get this done for this. So it was, yeah, a really swift writing process. And I got midway through a draft a call from Headlong saying that there might be a slot available sort of sooner than we were expecting, which was really the sort of kick up the arse I needed to get it finished, actually. I think I'd been nibbling around the edges of a first draft for a little while, and I think I had in my mind this pressure that I was putting on myself of going, this isn't just a play because you're taking on this very classic legend. This is like, you've got to do proper literature now. And I think that was something that was almost becoming a little bit incapacitating. And what I needed was a sort of fire lighting under me of saying, actually, can we have a draft within the next month? Can you get it done? And to which, of course, I say yes, because you always say yes. And yeah, it just sort of got the piece finished without the time to sort of worry about it too much.
So there have been a number of different takes on the Faust myth. You mentioned Marlowe's and Goethe's. And Nora asks, did you read many of these before starting work on your play? And if so, how did you balance hitting the well-known narrative plot points with wanting to do something different?
So the Marlowe and the Goethe are the two that I'm most familiar with. And then I've nibbled around the edges of various others, but those are certainly the principal ones. And I got a little bit frustrated of people describing it as an adaptation of the Marlowe, which it isn't. I feel it very much is its own thing. But because that's probably the one I'm most familiar with and almost certainly the version of the story that an audience is going to be the most familiar with, there are lots of sort of playful moments, I guess, sort of like Easter eggs. I very much wanted to create something that if you had no idea at all about any of the various different versions, had never seen or read the Marlowe, then you know you wouldn't lose out on anything. But there are little bits and pieces hidden. There's a figure that crops up towards the end of the play who doesn't even appear on stage but is referenced as Helen is out doing some great sort of persuading for Faustus somewhere. And I like the idea that in this version, this is the equivalent of a Helen of Troy, which is something that only I will really notice, but I'm a nerd and I find that quite satisfying. Other than that, I think it very much wanted to be its own thing. Like I do quote the Marlowe once. So there are 10 words of Marlowe in the whole text, which is the famous line of "Why this is hell, nor am I out of it," which in the Marlowe is a line given to Mephistopheles when Faustus asks him, well, it can't be that bad, can it? Because you're not in hell right now. You're here talking to me, roaming around. And Mephistopheles replies, no, I am constantly in hell, even when I'm having to deal with you. And in my version, that is a line that is given to Faustus when Mephistopheles asks her why she doesn't seem to have any fear of selling her soul or have any fear of hell. And her response is, why this is hell, nor am I out of it, to be a young woman of low birth in the world that I exist in. Like, this is the state that I exist. So there are definitely bits where I've been like riffing off the Marlowe and bouncing off it. But the story, I feel, takes the premise, the heart of the Faust myth, which sort of predates Marlowe, which goes, person sells his soul, there are consequences. And that's about the extent of which, in its extant form, the sort of the myth exists. That's, you know, that's what this story is. It hits certain beats in the first half that feels, I think, more attached to the Marlowe, and then in the second half of the show goes somewhere very different and probably has less in touch with it. If there is a particular human villain of the piece, there is Dr. Newbery, who I like to see as almost the equivalent of Marlowe's Faustus, in that he is a man who is a doctor, who is wealthy, who is bored, and who is trying to reach the devil through his arcane societies and friends in a similar sort of, I mean, is much more of a overtly wicked character than Marlowe's Faustus is, but almost sort of representing that side of the path that could have been taken if we were going down a more sort of traditional male Faustus route. And then so in a way, Johanna Faustus becomes the foil to him, and I guess in some way something of a rebuttal of Marlowe and of all those classic male Faustian figures.
Unlike the other versions you've mentioned, your retelling of the Faust myth has a female protagonist. We had a question from Jack who said, over the past few years, there's been an exciting movement to gender swap classic central characters, particularly in Shakespeare, but also elsewhere. Do you feel that this new take on well-known stories is an important way of correcting the gender imbalance in the theatre canon?
Yeah, I think that it does two things. If you're sort of talking about gender swapping, or rather if you're talking about making male characters female, doing inversion. So for instance, say having a male Juliet and a female Romeo or whatever, that feels like a slightly separate thing. But yeah, on the one hand, there's a very practical thing of going by the law of averages. For every brilliant, phenomenal actor out there capable of delivering a tour de force leading part, about half of them are going to be women. And if you look at the classical canon, like, the parts are not there. So there is some purely practical in going, you know, we all acknowledge there is a huge gender imbalance on our stages in the classical canon. There are brilliant actresses out there who are, you know, often playing sort of second fiddle, third fiddle, fourth fiddle, playing mothers, playing daughters, playing wives, not getting those title roles. So on a purely practical level, there's something to be said for writing parts for those people. And it also, I think it just makes these stories more interesting. I think when it's difficult sometimes is if you're talking about the classical canon and you're talking about the English classical canon or works written in the English language, the question then becomes, I think, how much do you change? And there's a difference between, so when, for instance, so if Maxine Peake is playing Hamlet, is she playing a man who is the Prince of Denmark? Is she playing a woman? And in this universe, Hamlet is a woman. And, you know, these sort of things have different implications. So how much do you change? Do you just change pronouns and that's it, and lords to ladies and so on and so forth? Well, maybe, but does that take into account, okay, so then what is the world of this play? How does that affect the power balance? How does that affect rules of hereditary, you know, who gets the crown in various different situations? I think that can feel slightly token. If you're restricted by the language, because actually one of the things about starting with Faustus was this is not a take on the Marlowe, this is its own thing, because if you make Faustus a woman, and I've moved the time slightly, but in this case, starting in the 1660s, it's a different story. You can't, in my mind, just, you know, do a version of Marlowe's Faustus, set it in the same period, and make that character a woman, because she would be treated differently. She would not have the same opportunities. She would not have the same access to power. She would not be a doctor. It's a different thing. So I'm always drawn towards being liberated by going into non-English texts where there's a degree, they have to be adapted because they have to be translated. So if you were to dive into the ancient Greek canon, for instance, although actually far better in terms of female representation already than the likes of Shakespeare, or if you know, dive into your more recent European or from anywhere, you're rewriting anyway. So you can then start to think, okay, well, if I'm doing an enemy of the people with a female lead, then I'm rewriting anyway. Where am I setting it? What's the socio-political landscape look like? How does gender exist in this world? If you're just doing, yeah, if you're just making Macbeth a woman, how much of the text are you then allowed to play with? How, where do you start sort of tying yourself in knots, I guess, to make those inversions work? I think they're really important, as I say, partially for the practical reason of just getting more female representation on stage. But I think sometimes productions can come undone if the sort of internal logic of the world doesn't feel really rigorous.
On the subject of the internal logic, I'm going to combine two questions we had from Carolina and Barbara, who asked, did you ever consider making Lucifer and Mephistopheles female, or would female devils have upset what you were saying about gender roles in a patriarchal society?
It is 100% something that we talked about. And it's something that Caroline Byrne, fantastic director, and I had quite a long conversation about. To me, it felt like Lucifer was always sort of out of the question, represents in its most totemic form, I guess, a sort of white male patriarchy in this version of the show, and also the way that it works in the script, with Lucifer doubling as the actor playing Lucifer doubling as Thomas, Johanna's father, felt like quite an important doubling there. But yeah, Caroline and I chatted quite a lot about whether or not we could have a female Mephistopheles, which of course has been done, certainly with the Marlowe, a number of times relatively recently in the One Acre Playhouse at the Globe, where they had both a female Faustus and Mephistopheles. And then we sort of started talking about what it would mean to have a female actor in that role, whether or not that would then necessarily mean that the character themselves then became female, or actually, you know, would they just be the right actor who might happen to be female playing a male figure? But that felt to me in this particular case like it might start to slightly muddy the water in terms of what we were saying about gender. And yeah, I felt in a way that Faustus is, you know, Faustus sort of makes her deal with the devil, and one of, you know, the terms that she states is, I am doing this so I can be, you know, no man can ever sort of control me again. And yet the irony of that is, in order to achieve that, she is sort of signing up to another system of patriarchy, of control, although she's argued herself a degree more autonomy within that. And so having a female Mephistopheles felt like it wasn't going to work for me. We did do the rounds and the thinking on how that might work, what it might be to try something that was felt a bit more genderless with that role. What became quite key to my thinking was the queering of Mephistopheles. That's where I sort of ended with the writing of him as a queer male figure. If you go back to things like sort of Paradise Lost, the Milton, and why Lucifer, why Mephistopheles, etc., choose to rebel against God, against the light. And Mephistopheles in my Faustus says, when asked by Faustus, why did you rebel? Why did you follow Lucifer? He replies, because he offered us light. And I think there is something nice in seeing a little bit of queer struggle, of queer oppression within this Mephistopheles, something that in my mind as a queer woman makes him a far more sympathetic figure, in fact, of going, he too has been oppressed and downtrodden and sneered on, and that's led him to rebel, that's led him to sort of violence and bitterness and everything else. But there's, in a way, that is something that he has in common with Faustus, although neither of them want to admit that they have anything in common at all. There is some sort of grudging bond between them that hopefully develops over the course of the play.
You mentioned queering Mephistopheles. Do you also think that queering these classic characters is an important way of addressing the imbalance of sexuality and gender identity in the theatre canon as well?
Yeah, again, in terms of queer representation, it feels quite important. I think, you know, certainly looking at the Shakespearean canon, I don't think it's short of homoeroticism or short of sort of queerness inherent in a lot of those plays, and the way that they play with gender and boys disguised as girls and others, and you know, and there was a fluidity there, which if you want to lean into it, is quite often there to be discovered. And sometimes in the right hands it's going to feel revelatory, in the wrong hands it's going to feel clunky. But I think that's probably an easier thing to do and layer in than to just start sort of arbitrarily changing the gender of characters without necessarily thinking very rigorously about how that's going to impact the rest of the landscape of the piece.
So Martin asked, to what extent are Johanna's choices driven by her own personality rather than by infernal forces?
That's a really good question. So I think it's really crucial that Johanna is making her own choices and does maintain free will and isn't being directly, is definitely being manipulated by the devil, and definitely like traps are being set for her continually. And sometimes she walks straight into them and sometimes she doesn't. I think the devil, well, both Lucifer and Mephistopheles know exactly how to push her buttons and have, you know, they've done this before with various other people throughout the course of time, probably in the world of this play and are sort of master manipulators. The first half of the play ends with Faustus inadvertently starting the Great Fire of London, commanding Mephistopheles to rid the city of the plague, but not specifying how he's allowed to do this, and it sort of backfires spectacularly. And yet, this is something that definitely, like Mephistopheles, has sown the seeds for this disaster to happen. But she does ultimately have free will. She does have the power to say no, to sort of turn down the offers of violence. And, you know, she hopefully goes on quite an extraordinary sort of journey and level of sort of growth throughout the show. So she begins being caught up with the idea of revenge, having first sold her soul. Well, first off, she wants to find the person or people responsible for her mother's death. And then we get the feeling that this is like spiraling really out of control into this sort of like bloodlust. And that could be where we ended up going with it, in a very kind of Jacobean, everybody a bloodbath, everyone sort of wiped out by the end of it, but with a sort of, you know, Kill Bill-esque sort of Tarantino take on that. And she's then sort of jolted out of that by the discovery that her father is sick and could die soon, and that she's been caught up in this search for vengeance and this sort of bloodlust, and actually that's the opposite of what she swore that she would do. There's quite a lot of growth and development in terms of what her motive changes, her goals change from vengeance to a desire to help, which becomes a very messianic thing that, you know, she takes the sort of weight of the world on her shoulders and doesn't believe that anybody else can live up to. No one can do what she can do because she's got these sort of supernatural powers, but doesn't really trust anybody else to get involved. And only after her sort of greatest act of destruction in the sort of climax of the piece does she come to a degree of sort of hope and faith, not in a religious sense, but faith in sort of humanity, that actually it's not just her job to fix things. And only having gone through all of this and lived for hundreds of years and seen through millennia can she sort of finally let go. And in the same time as well, she's sort of letting go of diabolical influence in that moment as well. Faustus has to make her own choices, not only for the nature of the play, but also I don't think it's any fun for the devil if the devil just gets to sort of hypnotize you into burning the city down. It's not anywhere near as fun as you make the choice and you make the bad choice and it blows up in your face. I think that is how the devil sort of claims victory.
Yeah, and she certainly learns from that Great Fire of London moment, doesn't she? She kind of sees how the wish, as it were, can be twisted and manipulated. And from there on, tries to do what she can sort of under her own steam, make her own achievements, which I really like. And we have a question from Zoe that she ties into this quite nicely. Zoe asked, is it in a way harder to write a character like Faustus who can do anything?
I hadn't really thought of it as that, in terms of, yes, when anything's possible, bar the sort of limits of the production budget, where do you go with it? Yeah, I think it's a really exciting thing to write. And, you know, it's a big play that sort of covers a lot of ground in just a little under 2 hours. So it's not sort of epically long, actually. And yeah, it can sort of go anywhere. I think we sort of try to crystallize her focus in a sort of redrafting purpose as well. It became really key that she had a sort of medical background through both her mother and her father, and therefore her efforts became focused around healing more than around anything else. And that felt like a sort of useful thing of, well, you could do literally anything, but this is at least where our attention is going to sort of fall and funnel. I think it's a great joy, really. It's a great gift to say, well, this play could go literally anywhere, and hopefully is able to sort of subvert expectations in doing so as well. Again, something that sort of slightly divided people, but I absolutely stand by, is how much the play sort of breaks itself in the middle. the first half feels like a relatively familiar, maybe, I mean, hopefully still sort of exciting and revisionist and everything else, but a relatively familiar form of telling a piece of historical drama with a feminist slant in a world that we might vaguely recognize. And then making a very, very clear and deliberate choice to go, now we're going to crack this play into, and we're going to go somewhere totally different with the second half of it, which hopefully an audience don't see coming. And I guess part of that is linked to this idea of, yeah, well, you know, if she can go anywhere, why would she stay here for a start? You know, I mean, that's something that she comes up against time and time again, actually, of going, okay, well, I've come forward 200 years, but it's still shit, I'm still limited. Or even, you know, okay, well, I've come forward another X years, things have got this much better, so how much better will they be? And so that idea of sort of chasing the sunset, always trying to see what's over the hill and push forward, push forward, push forward, is the sort of energy that drives the play and then starts to sort of spiral in on itself. So I've talked before about how structurally it sort of feels like it's a bit of a Fibonacci spiral in a way. So we spend about the first half of the play in the 1600s, the next quarter in the 1800s, the next eighth in the 2000s, and so on and so on, as the sort of play turns in on each other. And every time we jump forward in time, we're spending roughly half the amount of stage time there, and then we move on, to give this idea of time is running out, she can never do enough, she's always pushing forward, always pushing, never satisfied with anything that's happening around her. And I think that really links to that idea of, how do you write a character who can do anything? And is that a challenging thing of going, well, actually, it's challenging for the character. It's not as liberating, I think, as you might initially think, to go, I can do anything. Because you go, great, I know exactly where I'm going to get started. Or do you go, oh, God, what on earth can I do? I can do anything. That's terrifying. That's incapacitating. That's and if you can do anything, then anything you can do is probably wrong or not enough, because there was something else that you'll think of the second after you've done it. So I think the open-endedness of it is definitely like a writer's gift, because you can take the play anywhere. But in terms of the psychology of what it does to Faustus, I think it's sort of horrifying as well. This sort of like ultimate freedom, which is, you know, which is what she's sought and what she's been saying from day one, you know, I want to be my own master, I want to be in control. But to go from like so little little control, little autonomy in your daily life, to be being sort of handed the keys to the kingdom, hugely, hugely difficult to take that and run with it. And very crudely, that sort of is her undoing in a way. That is sort of what drives her mad, because she can never do enough until the very, very final scene of the play, where she basically has stopped and she's tending a garden and she's realized that it's not just up to her and there are other people, and she can sort of slow down a little bit, and the pace of that scene feels totally different to everything that's come in the sort of build-up in the last sort of 15-20 minutes of stage time before it, when it's been very sort of frenetic, high stakes, everything's been falling apart, to stopping and taking stock, which felt really key.
Isabella asked, how were the jumps in time realised in the production?
We mostly realised them through sound and video design. So we had this fantastic sort of wooden arc shape, sort of felt a little bit like the eaves of a church broken down, a little bit like the upturned hull of a ship, sort of conical, disappearing back, which could also sort of open up and close in, which was the idea of sort of her mind being closed or in the dark to begin with, and then gradually being able to be sort of opened up and expanded, but which also had gauze between certain panels which we could project onto. One of my favourite things as a writer is the impossible stage direction. And it's a great delight for writers. It's a nightmare for designers. So I apologise to Anna, our brilliant designer, for this. I think there's a stage direction which says 100 years of science and medicine pass. And it's like, yeah, okay, there you go. You do that. And yeah, so we sort of used overwhelming sound with sort of lots of bass, lots of rumble, to sort of be quite crude because I don't have the vocabulary to describe it better. And then, yeah, and would project these sort of, to begin with, relatively abstract images of sort of period specific, and then in that big 100 years passing sequence that we witness, lots of video footage with a real mixture of both the wonders and the horrors of science and medical progression. And we really, rather than watching it on a little screen, we really tried to make that projection cover sort of as much of the stage as it physically could to become quite a, again, quite a overwhelming thing for her as she sort of bears witness to all of that.
Ellie asks, were there scenes that you wrote that didn't make it into the final version?
Yes, there were. The first half of the play changed quite a lot. I don't know if I ever wrote it. I was definitely, we talked a lot about whether or not, so in the early scene, there's an idea that Thomas, Faustus's father, wants to marry her off. And I was interested in whether or not the fiancé should sort of be, or the would-be fiancé would be an actual character in the play. The opening scene, actually, we went back and forth on a lot. And the first draft of the opening scene was a young sort of, I don't know, say 10-year-old Faustus with her mother the night before her mother is going to be hung, as a witch sort of talking about how she'll go and plant flowers in the forest for her. And that ended up getting cut primarily because of the difficulties of getting a child actress just to do that one scene, then wouldn't come back, and the sort of financial implications of that. And that then became a scene between between Thomas, the husband, and Faustus's mother again the night before. And we would then sort of jump forward 20 years in time and start the play properly. And then struck upon the idea of it being what we saw in the final production, which was this sort of seance summoning where it's Faustus's sort of very fragmented memories and hearsay of what happened to her mother, both being dunked, tried as a witch, and then eventually hung, with Faustus being sort of dunked quite viciously, quite aggressively in this tank of water, which was a far more sort of powerful, punchy opening to the show. And then in the second half, yeah, quite a lot came and went. Quite a challenge because of going, well, in the second half of the play, we know that I knew the end point from sort of day one of writing. I knew where we were getting to, and that it was going to call back to the earliest sort of scenes of the play, and latching on really quite early to this idea of, has any of this really happened? How truthful is this? You know, sowing the seeds of doubt of actually she's just been feverish all this time and she hasn't moved forward at all. She hasn't done any of these things. But in order to get there, we go through thousands of years of history. So deciding where are we going to hit was sort of all up for grabs, and sort of looking at the logic of the world of, well, how far might she move forward in any given time, combined with what's going on in history at this time. So I remember I wrote a scene where she was practicing as a doctor in the very early 1900s, and I wrote a scene where she was tending to a young woman who was a suffragette who'd just been beaten up by police in a raid, and the suffragette was sort of challenging her on why, yeah, she'll sort of patch us up, but she's not getting actively involved, and she's not doing more, and maybe she could, and sort of Faustus is making excuses. I had various ideas of, because when we meet the four horsemen later on, or the three horsemen initially, war, famine, and pestilence, of how clever do I need to be with the doubling of those? Do I plant seeds? So, for instance, in that scenario, the young suffragette had been on hunger strike. Is she going to represent famine in some way? Are there other things? So is war going to be represented by a specific scene she has revolving conflict? And so there were various different sort of things that I tried out, lots of, yeah, drafts of scenes and characters came and went in that process. But the arc, certainly where it was going to start and where it was going to end, was quite clear in my mind from the get-go.
So Julie said, the play includes lots of detail about witchcraft, rituals and science. How much research did you have to do into these subjects?
I did a fair bit of research. I mean, probably not exhaustive. I would say I've got a small-sized shelf full of books that were sort of, that helped me through, including, yeah, very interesting sort of history of British witchcraft, specifically British witchcraft, which I sort of dipped in and out of, and which had some quite good sort of practical details in terms of how ceremonies might have taken place. A really fascinating book, which I think was stolen by one of the casks, I left it in the rehearsal room, on like Gothic science, which when I started reading, sort of tangentially talking about Frankenstein, but also sort of and how the creation of Frankenstein was both informed by science but then also influenced scientific thought after it was published as well, which is really interesting. I would absolutely not claim to be an expert on witchcraft or any of the sort of historical details, but I made sure that I knew enough to avoid, hopefully, any particularly glaring errors. I think one of my great talents as a writer, actually, which is pure fortune, is to be able to sort of gain a surface knowledge of something which appears deeper than it actually is, and that's been sort of standing me in quite good stead so far.
Throughout the play, there are sections in verse, including some in blank verse, and we had a question about this from Peter, who asked, what made you decide to include this element of the play, and did you find the blank verse difficult to write?
I really love writing in verse, actually, and it's something that I'm quite familiar with, both blank and otherwise. So things like when I did my adaptation of Pericles for the National a couple of years back, that was using lots of the original Shakespeare plus lots of contemporary stuff that wasn't in verse, and then lots of bits where I'm sort of patching in between where hopefully you won't really notice what's Shakespeare and what's me. So it wasn't something I felt really daunted by. It's something I find really, yeah, really satisfying, really enjoyable to write in, actually. And yeah, and it felt like a nice structural link, I guess, between things like the Marlowe and the Goethe and other forms, and sort of doing something new with it. There's quite a bit of fairly strict, proper blank verse, iambic pentameter in it, and then a separate form of like free verse narration, which various figures use when talking to us as chorus. So Garrett has a sort of narration monologue in a sort of free verse, as does Violet. There's a moment, which again, it's one of these sort of really like nerdy writer things, where Violet, I think, yes, it is Violet, is describing what happens after Faustus has visited Newbury and done the sort of transformation with the horns and everything else. And I think it goes, and Faustus goes and heads up to the heath. The night is cool, the moon is bright and high. And in that moment, she feels something break. And those three lines, which I might have got slightly wrong, are very sort of well-constructed, technically speaking, blank verse. And in that moment, she feels something break, which goes on to a separate line. And that is the last moment of blank verse in the entire script. And that was a very deliberate choice of going, she's freed herself of something in that moment. And one way, which, you know, an audience is certainly not going to be consciously aware of, probably, but one way of signifying this sort of newfound freedom that Faustus has had, not from the point of view of signing her deal, because that's not really about freedom, that's sort of constraining her in a different way, but in her sort of punishment of Newbury, which is the first time that she's sort of really taking control, taking action, finding a bit more practical autonomy. No one speaks in verse after this, or no one speaks in blank verse out of this, in this very sort of regimented, tidy, iambic form, because that in itself is a sort of form of shackle which she casts off.
Jamie asked, did you ever consider moving away from the ending of the original myth entirely and giving Faustus redemption?
Well, of course, Faustus does sometimes get redeemed. In the Goethe, Faustus gets redeemed. And I think my Faustus does get redeemed as well, actually, depending on how you look at it. The sort of ending is very intentionally ambiguous to a degree, to the extent of which even the cast disagree on what exactly it means and what they're playing, which is lovely, and which I encourage. Because, you know, I mean, this is sort of what she says in her final speech. She says, Faustus may be damned, but she is not lost. And she comes to this revelation by realizing, for really the first time, and it does take her, you know, the length of the play and several thousand years to sort of accept that she is not the center of the universe, which, you know, she's got some issues and she's got some stuff to work through. But in that moment, in the final moment, or in the penultimate moment rather, because the final moment is slightly different, but she's able to go, you know what, I might be damned. Ultimately, though, that doesn't matter. I am one person, and for the first time in my entire existence, I have faith, not religious faith, but faith that there will be other people who will come after me and they will sort this shit out. So actually, and I don't know that, and that's, you know, the important thing about faith in all contexts is that if you've got proof, you can't have faith, actually. You can only really have faith with uncertainty, and uncertainty is terrifying, and we don't like it, and it's difficult to accept. But if you can accept uncertainty, you can also welcome in faith at the same time, which is what she sort of finds in these final moments. So actually, she might be damned forever, but she does find a degree of peace with that, which I think is a real victory and not what the devil wanted. You know, it's not a sort of straightforward black and white ending. Then, of course, the clock does strike 12. And on that final strike of 12, she turns around and she says, wait. And then we cut to black, which sort of echoes the opening scene when her mother is hung, who also like makes a strong, impassioned speech where she seems to find a degree of autonomy and confidence, knows that she's about to die, but finds some strength. But we always want more time. And I think that's just like a very, very, very human thing, that actually, you know, a split second earlier, she'd had this sort of this hope, this strength, this whatever, but actually, I can't get away from the fact that we always do, as humans, want just a little bit more time. So she's conflicted, but I don't think that she's beaten. I don't think this is a play where unambiguously the devil wins. And that felt quite important, I think.
So how are you spending your time in lockdown?
I'm mostly spending my time in lockdown decorating and demolding a new flat, which is taking up most of my time at the moment and was sort of mankier than we thought it was going to be when we got the keys. So we've been here for just under a month now and we're starting to get things how we like them. There's a little bit of work still to do.
And do you have any advice for writers currently living in lockdown?
The best advice I could give really is just be nice to yourself. Give yourself a break. My partner said something really brilliant about lockdown, which was it sort of forces upon you all the sort of physical symptoms of depression, whether or not you're actually depressed. So you don't go out and see your friends. You don't go out and get fresh air. You don't have a proper routine or a sleep schedule or whatever. And like, it's going to make you feel rubbish. And I think at the beginning of lockdown, or certainly earlier on into it, sort of, you know, going, well, if somebody had told me actually that there were going to be a space of a couple of months where I didn't have to worry about going in for meetings or rehearsals or anything else, I could just sort of set myself up and write and read and sort of work on projects. And, you know, being a writer, it's quite a self-starting thing anyway. And I've been great. It sounds like I'm having a really lovely holiday and I'm going to get lots done and it's going to be brilliant. That's not been the case at all. It's been the case for most writers that I know. Weirdly, my head has been very well positioned for sort of pitching and for coming up with concepts and writing sort of, a 2-3 page treatment for something. And I found that much easier to do than actually sitting down and getting on with, you know, drafting an actual script and writing dialogue. And I don't really know why that is. But I think, acknowledge that these are difficult and uncertain times. Not to despair, because things will get better. They are going to get better eventually. But that if, you know, there is no pressure to write Lear, which is probably a stupid apocryphal story anyway, you know, getting through each day is enough. If you can write, brilliant. Get out of the house if you can. Although also on practical advice too, I think it's not a bad time to be doing bits of remote networking and chasing people up. And because a lot of some people are just on furlough and off email, and I understand that, but certainly there are some people who I think within the industry who are less busy or maybe more able to have meetings and talk to you than they are normally when they're at their desks and trickier to get hold of. I was talking to a producer recently who said, yeah, it's brilliant. Whenever I call someone up now, they answer the phone, which was nice. So yeah, just be kind, do what you can, and know that there is going to be something the other side of it, I think.
Thank you so much for speaking to us today, Chris. It's been really great to talk to you about Faustus, That Damned Woman.
Thanks very much. Pleasure to chat to you.
Thank you for listening to the Playgroup Q&A podcast from Nick Hearn Books. The next free play to read has now been released on our website. So head to www.nickhearnbooks.co.uk/playgroup to find out what it is. Once you've read it, send in your question for the writer at playgroup@nickhearnbooks.co.uk. We'd like to thank Chris Bush for taking part and all of you who sent in a question. We didn't have time to ask all of them, but we hope you'll keep the discussion going online. For now, take care and see you next time.